I'm Brad Linder, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller's off this evening. Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign is stepping up voter registration efforts in Pennsylvania ahead of next week's deadline. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports Vice President Joe Biden led the charge, speaking today to a crowd of about 700 people at Bucks County Community College.
The vice president was late to the event at the Bucks County Community College's Bristol campus. After remarks by local candidates, Biden vouched for Clinton, a presidential hopeful some have accused of being too cold or calculating.
When she was Secretary of State, she had breakfast with me every Tuesday morning for somewhere between an hour and a half to go over foreign policy issues. And I know her, and I know her heart as well as I know what she stands for and what she wants to do.
As time to register to vote in Pennsylvania ticks down to Tuesday's deadline, Clinton's campaign is holding a slew of registration events targeting college campuses. In Bucks, the vice president had this message for anyone waffling about whether to participate.
And there's been a lot of elections. Remember Al Gore? He ended up, but keep it in mind, man. Keep it in mind.
Due to the high-profile visit, classes at the Lower Bucks campus were canceled. Sophomore Gloria Hart came anyway.
Well, I think this election is very, different than any other election. And we came out here just because we wanted to support Hillary Clinton because, I feel like she has more experience than Donald Trump.
Recent polls in Pennsylvania give Clinton as much as a 9-point lead over Trump. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
New Jersey lawmakers have voted to approve a 23-cent per gallon hike in the gas tax to pay for transportation work. The Democrat-led Senate and Assembly today approved raising the tax from 14.5 cents a gallon to 37.5 cents a gallon to fund transportation work over 8 years. Assembly Speaker Vinny Prieto knows there's a lot of public opposition to the gas tax hike, but he says it's needed to pay for road and bridge repairs.
Tell me somebody that would love to have their taxes raised, especially in the state of New Jersey. You're not going to find one person. I know people don't want to pay more at the pump, but this is a public safety issue.
The legislation also cuts the sales and estate taxes, among other measures. We're only 2 days away from the second of three scheduled debates between presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. In this week's edition of What Are We Thinking?, Newsworks Tonight's Dave Heller spoke with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll, about which topics the American public wants to see discussed.
Frank, I understand you'll be on hand in St. Louis.
That's right. This is the town hall format that the Commission on Presidential Debates has come up with, the second debate, and that includes live human beings who will be on stage asking questions of Trump and Clinton. Some of the questions will come in via social media, but at least half the questions will be those live humans on stage. And Gallup was tasked, as we have in past reviews, with the responsibility of selecting those uncommitted voters who will be up there on stage in St. Louis Sunday night.
Though, to what extent will those live human beings' questions be pre-screened?
We don't know what the questions are whatsoever when we screen and randomly select these individuals to come to the debate. But the moderators, who are Anderson Cooper and Martha Raddatz, Cooper of CNN, Raddatz of ABC News, will huddle with the individuals who were selected ahead of time, and they'll make sure that they're not getting, say, five questions in a row on Social Security. They want some diversity, so they'll know what the individuals are planning to ask.
Above and beyond these live human beings, do we have a firm sense of what the public at large would like to see the candidates talk about?
Indeed we do. And in fact, I looked carefully at the first debate at Hofstra University, and at least three of the things that are at the top of the public's priorities were discussed there. The economy and jobs is number one, and Lester Holt of NBC News started right out with the economy and jobs in that first debate, and that was good. Racism was discussed and race issues, and that's important. And national security and terrorism was discussed, and that's important as well. So I imagine those three will come up at this debate as well. The things that did not come up at the Hofstra debate, which I would hope the people in St. Louis will ask the candidates about in the upcoming debate, were dysfunctional government, how Congress is not working well, according to the American public. This is one of the major trends in all of our data here at Gallup, and we didn't hear much about it at all in the first debate, so I hope that comes up again. And, interestingly, immigration is one of the top five or six problems on Americans' minds, and even though that's been a Trump signature issue, wasn't discussed much in the first debate, so we'll see if that comes up on Sunday night.
Do perceptions about dysfunction in government tend to favor Donald Trump, who is obviously the outsider, certainly relative to Hillary Clinton?
Indeed, they do. Republicans in general are on the right side of this issue, at least as far as a lot of our questioning are concerned, in the sense that Americans are more likely to say government should do less and leave more to individuals and business, rather than to say government should do more and try to do more to fix problems.
Perhaps to get a better sense of efforts to court the remaining undecided voters, why don't we look at the population subsets who are already in the Trump and or Clinton camp?
The way I would typify it is, and this is again based on the images of the candidates, and I would say Donald Trump's support tends to be in large groups of more traditional Americans, where Hillary Clinton's largest support comes from a large list of smaller subgroups of American society. And the biggest large group that Trump has support from is white Americans. In fact, when we look at all the groups, it's older Americans, white Americans, Protestants, which is about half of all Americans, the biggest religious group in America, married individuals, those who are highly religious, males, we know that, and individuals who don't have college degrees. All of those types of people are where Trump finds his most positive imagery. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, it's all very much smaller groups. Muslims, black Americans, about 13% of Americans, Hispanics, those who are identify themselves as LGBT, Jewish Americans, just about 2% of Americans, those who are not married in general, Asians, and those who have low incomes, and also, interestingly, Americans that have a high level of education, that is beyond college. So it's niche support on the one hand versus broad support among some large groups on the other for Trump.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
During this Sunday's presidential debate, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump will get another opportunity to make the case for their big policy plans. One area where there are clear differences is in the candidates' positions on energy and environmental issues. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
Remember this from the first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump?
Donald thinks that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. I think it's real.
I do not say that.
And I think it's important that we...
Actually, he did say that in a now infamous tweet from 2012, and then again during the Republican primaries, though he later said he was only kidding. This is actually an important point, energy experts say, because what the candidates think about climate change dominates what each would do as president on energy issues. Jim Sweeney is an engineering professor at Stanford.
Hillary Clinton recognizes what the entire scientific community recognizes. Global climate change is real. It's caused by human sources. It creates problems, and we need to do something about global climate change.
Sweeney says that's a stark contrast to what Donald Trump and his campaign have said about climate. After the whole climate is a hoax issue came up during the debate, the campaign attempted to clarify his views. His surrogates have said that Trump believes global climate change is real, but it's only caused by nature, and human actions have no impact on it.
That's basically inconsistent with the science.
And so it follows that Trump's energy plan is fossil fuel heavy, with a steady diet of drilling, mining, and fewer regulations. Here he is at a natural gas conference in Pittsburgh in September.
Producing more American energy is a central part of my plan to making America wealthy again, especially for the poorest Americans.
Trump has pledged to bring back the coal industry by cutting regulations. That's a long shot because regulations weren't the main reason coal production is at a 30-year low in the U.S. That culprit is cheap natural gas from fracking. Sweeney says Trump can't help both coal and gas.
He's also promised to help the natural gas industry, and so I don't see how he could do both simultaneously.
A Trump energy advisor, North Dakota Congressman Kevin Cramer, told State Impact Oklahoma the two candidates just have different views on the role of government in determining how Americans get their energy.
Are we going to unleash the innovation of the private sector by working with energy industry and stakeholders on an environmental policy that is realistic, that is actually helpful, that doesn't kill the innovator?
Trump has said he would back the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, which 195 countries agreed to last year in order to avoid runaway climate change. But that could be difficult for Trump to do, experts say. This month, enough countries ratified the deal to put it into force.
That means that
it'll take at least 4 years for any U.S. president to unwind our obligation under international law under the Paris Agreement.
Varun Sivaram is with the Council on Foreign Relations and has advised the Clinton campaign on climate and energy policy. Sivaram says Trump could still reverse some of the policies the U.S. could use to meet its climate obligations, like the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan to reduce carbon emissions from the power sector. Clinton, on the other hand, wouldn't do that. Here she is at a rally near Seattle in March.
I will protect, defend, and build on that work, but we've got to go further. I've set some big goals. I want to see us deploy a half a billion more solar panels by the end of my first term.
That's part of her plan to ramp up solar capacity by 700% in just 4 years.
That's an unbelievably high target.
Again, Varun Sivaram.
It's an ambitious one, and it's, you know, I think we can achieve it. But it's not easy. It's not going to happen on autopilot. She will actually have to do things in order to achieve that target.
To do all this, Clinton proposes modernizing the country's electricity grid, putting renewable energy projects on public lands, and investing heavily in renewables research and development. If she can pull off all those things with a Congress that's likely to be resistant to her ideas, maybe, just maybe, she can make her campaign promise a reality. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
For the past 3 years, an organization called Coded by Kids has been helping young Philadelphians learn to develop software. Sylvester Mobley started Coded by Kids in 2013, and now the program reaches about 90 kids through classes at rec centers and after-school programs. Now he's launching an effort to expand the program to reach more kids throughout the city. Sylvester, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me a little bit about how this all started.
I was working in tech as a project manager, and I kept noticing a lack of diversity in tech, and I wanted to find a way that I could use my skills and my experience to address that. I wanted to take a step back and separate race, religion, sex, and things like that that are common discriminators within the tech industry and say, if I separate these things out, what's the common thread? And that common thread that I kept landing on was education. The average student that's graduating from a school in the city of Philadelphia is not getting the computer science and tech education that's adequate to go into the tech industry. So we started out as me teaching web development to one child at a rec center on Saturday mornings.
And how do you go from one kid to now you've got classes at multiple locations, around 90 kids? How did that happen?
So we had that one kid for a while. His mom sent his brother, so we went from one to two, and she sent his brother because she felt more sorry for me than anything else. After a while, more and more kids started to learn about the program, more and more parents started to find out, and once parents started to find out what we were doing, we were pretty fortunate to get a lot of good word of mouth, and you know, kids just started coming. And in time, more people started to come to volunteer. More kids start to come. Before I knew it, we needed to add a second day at the rec center we were at. School started to come to me saying, hey, we really like what you're doing. Would you be willing to do this at our school? We started working more with the city, who said, hey, we really like what you're doing at this one rec center. You know, would you like to do it at more rec centers? And, you know, we just grew from there.
You'd mentioned one of your primary goals here is to sort of increase diversity in the tech field. How are you reaching out to kids that might otherwise not take advantage of opportunities like this?
By being in rec centers and communities, we're central. You know, we're right there in the community. So kids that normally wouldn't have exposure to a program like this, they're able to wander in. And also, our classes are free. So we've removed all the barriers. We've essentially said we're going to remove location as a barrier, and we're going to remove cost as a barrier. We're going to be at a rec center in your community, so we're going to be as accessible as sports are. We also target schools that are primarily serving kids that are coming from low-income and underserved populations. So by targeting those schools, we're getting kids that wouldn't normally have access to these opportunities.
Part of the reason we're talking right now is that you're going from having a couple of classes teaching about 90 kids a week into trying to expand to an even larger audience. Tell me a little bit about your plans for expansion.
So up until this point, we've done a lot with very little. And we want to expand what we're able to do. We want to increase our reach. We want to increase our reach because of the need. We have parents who are contacting us all the time about the programs. We have parents in, you know, who aren't in the neighborhood of the rec center that we're in. We have parents whose kids don't go to schools that we're in, who are always saying, hey, you know, when can I get my child in? You know, when are you coming to my neighborhood? So we really want to be able to expand that reach that we have and impact more kids and give this to more kids because there's a need for it, because there's, you know, there's a strong desire for it, and because it's important. Our five-year goal is to be able to teach 5,000 kids on a consistent basis programming and software engineering. So we're starting this year with a relatively small number just to start pushing forward. You know, we want to expand by 150 kids a week. And then we're going to expand, you know, year over year after that.
What have you taken away from this?
I've learned that kids can be brutal. This is me talking as a former Marine, but it's also the most rewarding thing I've ever done. You know, we've been around long enough now where we're essentially watching kids grow up. You know, I ran into one of my kids he's in college. He's at Westchester University now. So to see one of your kids who's now in college, you're like, man, like, you know, it feels good to have a role in that development.
Sylvester, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you.
That's Sylvester Mobley, founder of Coded by Kids. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. The Barnes Foundation is opening an exhibit of old photographs related to its renowned collection of Impressionist paintings. The photos are turn-of-the-century fine art pictures made in Paris, the same time and place where most of the Barnes collection originated. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports fine art photography at the time was trying to catch up to painting.
The Barnes collection is filled with priceless paintings by Degas, Renoir, Matisse, and others from that heady time in Paris in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. At the same time, photography was finding its feet as an artistic medium. Photography collector Michael Mattis says photographers were influenced by the abstraction of the Impressionists.
Well, I would say that the influence was mutual. One of the pictures in this show that, in fact, is the closest connection to the Barnes is taken by Degas himself. In 1895, Degas, the painter, Edgar Degas, caught the camera bug. And for the next 18 months, he drove everybody crazy who came over for dinner or at a social setting by asking them to pose for his camera.
Mattis loaned several dozen photos from his private collection to the Barnes for Live and Life Will Give You Pictures, an exhibition of French photography from 1890 to 1950. It includes vintage prints of the River Seine by moonlight, crowded street scenes, aging and bejeweled matrons in bistros, and prostitutes in brothels. The photographers were using ideas developed by painters of the time, often emphasizing lines and shapes, just as their friends, they were often friends, were doing with paint. Both painters and photographers were able to change the way we look at images because of technology. Barnes executive director Tom Collins says photography lagged behind.
The kinds of subjects, like the crowd on the street, couldn't be captured in photography. You know, it was only with the advent of Kodak's smaller portable camera and roll film in 1888 that it's possible to capture the kind of fleeting and evanescent face of modernity that was so central to Impressionism.
Collins says this show of photography, a first for the Barnes, reflects the institution's mission of advancing visual literacy. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Tonight, the Philadelphia Orchestra will perform a cello concerto by Saint-Saëns, featuring a young soloist from Montreal who will be playing one of the world's most valuable instruments. The 300-year-old Stradivarius cello is named the Countess of Stainline. In the 19th century, it was owned by Niccolo Paganini, and in the 20th century by Bernard Greenhouse of the Beaux Arts Trio. 4 years ago, it was sold at auction for an undisclosed amount, likely around $6 million, and loaned to Stéphane Tétreau, who was just 19 at the time.
The depth of sound, the variety of colors, it has an unbelievable palette of color. Quite an experience to play this cello. Definitely is alive. It has an incredible personality, a lot of different character traits that you have to deal with, you have to get to know, and it has a huge history. For me, it's an immense privilege and also a great responsibility. Sometimes you can get away with saying, oh yeah, I'd like to do this on the cello, but you know, it doesn't work or it doesn't respond, and I have zero excuses, zero excuses. It really has an immense possibility.
That's Stéphane Tétreau playing one of the most highly coveted instruments in the world, a 300-year-old Stradivarius cello. He'll perform with the Philadelphia Orchestra tonight and tomorrow. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. The news director is Eugene Son. Our engineers this week were Al Banks and Diana Martinez. Sandra Clark is vice president of News and Civic Dialogue. You can listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Brad Linder for NewsWorks Tonight.